Hello and welcome to Conker's Corner. Today I have the privilege of speaking with Tim Price, who's an award-winning fund manager and author. He's also writes for Money Week and has been around and been sought after regarding all things to do investing and bonds for over 25 years. Good morning, Tim, and how are you?
Very good, thank you. I've been in the market for 25 years. I'm only 26, you know.
I do realise that, but your name seems to have been everywhere. And I think it's always a credit to see somebody who is sought after, because you know full well that they're then skilled and an expert in their field.
The check's in the poster, Peter.
You're more than welcome, sir. Now, Tim, although some of my listeners and some of the ones that listen to us globally will be aware of you, I always start with... just a little recap of, so that everyone gets a little bit of an understanding of who Tim Price is, how did he start, what was his first sort of exposure to investing, etc. So I wanted to go back a little bit to you as a young person, teen, etc., wherever you wanted to start.
Okay. So I read English at university and fully intended to go into to pursue a career in media. But sadly, in 91, which was when I graduated, there weren't that many jobs, or at least not that many for me. So I took the first thing that I could do, and the first thing that I could get was perversely a position as a fixed income salesman. So I started out in the bond market, working for a Japanese bank. That became working for what was Paribas and then Merrill Lynch. And so I spent 10 years in the credit markets, and around the turn of the millennium, moved into private client work. Yeah. And that's really when the scales started to fall from my eyes. So for anyone that's unaware, the problem with the city and investment banking is that it tends to be very silo oriented. So in other words, you start out, say, in fixed income in the bond market, and then you start specializing, and then you become, say, a German government bond trader, and then you end up becoming like a German 2 to 3 year government bond trader.
Yeah.
And it gets increasingly sort of specialist. Whereas making the move voluntarily to private client wealth management, fund management, all of a sudden, suddenly you get to play in all kinds of different areas. So, for example, I got to play in, I say play, but I mean, I'm talking about sort of serious sort of long-term investment, I hope.
Yeah, yeah.
But you got to oversee and participate in markets like equities. So the full range of the global stock market, across bonds, across currencies, hedge funds, you know, alternative assets, everything. And that's when life started to get a lot more interesting. So I've been a private client fund manager now for the last 15 years.
Okie dokie. So just going back a little bit, prior to going to Oxford, I know you went to Oxford University and that's where you qualified. But prior to that, you say you already knew that's what you wanted to go into journalism, you wanted to go to uni. But where did the interest, why did you end up going from journalism to say there's no jobs, obviously, but you went into that?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I was applying to positions in media and advertising businesses. Yeah. And as I said, I just couldn't get any positions there. And around that time, I've got an older brother, and he read economics at Cambridge, so he knew he wanted to go into trading as a profession.
Yeah.
And so his advice was simply, look, you know, I know you're applying to media businesses, but don't forget the city, because A, it's interesting, and B, it pays well. And he wasn't wrong. So it turned out that I ended up getting my sort of second best choice.
Yeah. Okie dokie. So when you started in journalism, what sort of field were you covering initially?
Well, I got some work experience when I was a student on I'd worked for a magazine called Literary Review back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And that was the editor of that was a lovely man called Auburn Waugh, son of Evelyn Waugh.
All right,
so I did that for 2 summers. I spent some time in advertising.
Right.
So I'm from Solihull in the West Midlands.
Right.
And the big ad agency called Cogent Elliott. And I spent some summers working there again as an intern and getting some work experience. So that's the kind of stuff that I'd done. And I had an interest in, I've always liked to write. So I've always enjoyed writing. And happily for me, although I've been in the financial services arena for the last quarter century, I've managed to sort of vicariously shove writing in as part of the day job. So I've been writing since I started work.
Okay, I mean, I'm going to touch onto your book now. I mean, it's very interesting that you chose the title, Looking Through the Looking Glass, in the sense of the sequel to Alice in Wonderland is like a homage to that.
Yeah, so Investing Through the Looking Glass is really designed, well, I suppose the genesis of it, there's two. One is that a company called Harriman House, a guy called Craig Pierce called me, and yeah. somebody said, would I like to write a book about investing? And having thought about it for about half a millisecond, I said, yeah, I'd love to. And secondly, the sort of longer version of this is that, you know, since 2008, since, excuse me, since the credit crisis and particularly the failure of Lehman Brothers, I'd been asking myself, how on earth did we get into this mess? And I think we're still in that mess, by the way. I don't think we've conclusively broken out of that sort of recessionary environment. Anyhow, so the book is really my attempt to answer that. How did we get into the mess, and you know, how can we try and avoid it in future, hopefully?
I think lots of people, Tim, are still asking that question, how we got in that mess. I think the great thing about your book is that you've tried to answer some of them, you know, going from start to finish, and also trying to give some guides as to how people could actually maneuver through the uncertainty.
Yeah, I mean, I think this I'm coming at it from essentially from two different directions. So on the one hand, there's the sort of macro perspective, you know, and that touches on, touches on the stability of the financial system, on the nature of banking, central banking, and so forth. And on the other hand, it's then, okay, practical advice for the investor. So I'm quite critical about many different facets of the financial services world, but I'm also trying to point to some, hopefully, some ways through the woods.
Indeed. I mean, one of the you touched on the fact that one of the main problems we've got across the board is the issue of debt. You know, and that's an ongoing thing for, you know, whether it be the US, whether it be the UK or the likes of smaller countries like Argentina.
Yeah. So, again, I mean, it probably betrays the fact that I spent a decade in the bond market as a sort of bond, albeit as a bond generalist, if you like.
Yeah.
But the way for me, debt is basically ground zero of this problem. So I would suggest that the reason the financial world is in the problem, is in the mess that it's in, the pickle that it's in, is because there is too much debt in the system, and there are really only three ways of trying to resolve that. The first way is that you engineer enough economic growth to service the debt. I'd argue in Europe, in the Eurozone, that's now impossible. The second outcome is that you default, governments default on their debts, and that sounds maybe easy, but a default for a government, although it can repudiate its debt, which is a liability to the government, is also the asset for the person who holds it.
Indeed.
So if governments did default on a broader basis, they would destroy the banking and pension industry. What's in box number three is inflation. And it's the tried and tested answer to too much debt that governments have resorted to since we've had markets.
Indeed it is. I mean, the problem you've got there, though, is similar to the financial crisis. It just starts off a domino process, doesn't it?
Exactly. But I think that's really the only range of outcomes that there can be. So the question is, what do we get? And I think maybe we get a bit of all of them.
Right. Okay. So you obviously touched on the bond market and the fact that, you know, it's been expanding and expanding, and it doesn't seem to ever stop. And now we're on the cusp of what could be, or has started to be, a little bit of a mini collapse over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, it feels to me like the cycle may finally be turning after 35 years. So, I mean, yields were starting to back up already in the summer. Mm-hmm. And then the Trump victory in the US presidential elections has really given, you know, the bond market a bit of a scare. Because there's widely accepted so-called reflation trade now at work. So expectations that Trump is going to bring in tax breaks, infrastructure spending, and he's going to basically add another God knows how many trillion dollars to the U.S. national debt, which is already pushing $20 trillion.
Yeah.
So long story short, although bond markets may have a bit of a technical rally, I think the damage has been done now.
Okay, so within your book, I mean, you're obviously an ex-fund manager, and you're still,
I'm still a current, hopefully still a current fund manager.
And it's not because your book you've become an ex-fund manager, I do apologise.
So he knows what the future may hold.
Yeah, you're a fund manager.
2016 is that kind of a year.
Indeed it is. Apologies there, Tim. So as a fund manager, you've also laid some blame, obviously, at the fund managers, past and present, as to how things have gotten to the way they've got to.
Yeah, I mean, again, it starts out really with the critique of the way bond funds are managed. And it all comes down to benchmarking. So one reason why the bond market has been so overvalued is because most bond fund managers are benchmarked to some kind of an index. Mm-hmm. And if you think about the logic of a bond benchmark basically allocates the largest percentage of the index to the most heavily indebted issuers.
Yeah.
Well, if you think about it, that's absolute nonsense, because the most heavily indebted issuers are the poorest quality borrowers. So it makes sense to, if you're going to lend your money to somebody, an entity, in this case a government, it makes sense to lend your money only to somebody who can afford to pay you back. Well, the US, the UK, most of Western Europe are insolvent by any objective measure.
Yeah.
So they're poor credit risks. The markets that are worth buying, if you want to buy bonds at all, which you may not, but if you do want to buy bonds, the markets you want to buy, they're the bonds issued by creditor countries that don't need to borrow in the first place.
Indeed. So the argument that there's always somebody out there smarter than the other person, is that, does that remain
well,
true?
Well, I think that's just sort of conventional thinking, but I'm not sure right. It holds in fund management.
Right.
And you have the same kind of problem in equity management, in you know, people investing in the stock market, in that, again, there's an awful lot of benchmarking going on. And the equity benchmarks. So, for example, if you're a global equity manager, and yeah. we are effectively in the fund,
yeah.
then most global equity managers are probably pursuing some kind of index like MSCI Global Equity or World Equity Index. The MSCI index, 60% of that index is in the US. So whether or not you think US stocks are cheap, you have to have roughly two-thirds of your portfolio in them. Well, again, right. That's nonsense.
Okay, so we've had Lehman Brothers. We've had... RBS on the cusp for a while. We've now got Deutsche Bank on the cusp or appearing to be on the cusp. What is the answer for these banks? Are they going to have to incorporate lots of fintech and just split themselves into the middle and do completely differently what they've done in the past?
I don't know how these issues are going to resolve themselves. Put it this way: if I was sort of Grand High Ming of the universe or some kind of like Uber regulator, I'd just let them fail. But and that's not really an option, is it?
No,
but
at the moment.
Effectively, what I'd do would be I'd go back in time to 2008 and basically try and lay the path for some kind of great reset rather than just throwing taxpayers' money at these guys. And, you know, because part of the problem with that is that you had billions and billions and billions of dollars thrown at the banks across the world, but particularly in the US, and that money went straight through without touching the sides, and ended up as bonuses. That is just so disgusting in so many ways. And I'm amazed that, you know, you haven't seen more bankers thrown in jail.
Right. I mean, I think lots of people have questioned that as well. And I mean, to stop the some of the cultures within some of the banks. And, you know, that's something that needs to be worked on.
Yeah, I mean, this is maybe gets to the heart of the problem that we have lived through and are living through, if you like, the greatest experience of moral hazard in world history. That bad behavior, literally bad behavior. I mean, so I'm not just talking about poor quality outcomes. I'm talking about immoral, unethical behavior.
Yeah.
It's basically been massively rewarded, and there's no way that's remotely acceptable morally. But that's what we've had.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people have a lot of questions to answer.
Indeed. So talking about questions to answer, you've now got certain individuals. And that are coming up to a certain age, they're being offered the right to sell their pensions off and, you know, capture some of the value now. I've been having discussions with various people saying, look, I'm 48 now, and it's unlikely that I may even have a state pension. And those that are, you know, in their 20s and 30s, there won't be one.
Yeah, I'd be minded to agree with that rather gloomy prognosis.
Yeah. So the solutions then that you talked about in your book, Tim, regarding people and individuals and entities preserving the capital they've got and also looking to maintain the wealth that they've got now rather than it being either, you know, inflated away or deflated away as circumstances may prevail.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of citations in the book, a lot of references to things that I've enjoyed coming across during the course of the last 25 years. And so I've given, I think, fair accreditation to people whose ideas and whose other writings have interested me.
Yeah.
And the one that maybe stands out in this regard is a book called Against the Gods by Peter Bernstein, an American author.
Okay.
And within that, I mean, he died a few years ago, but within that he cited another writer, well, a Renaissance man, effectively, a guy called Daniel Bernoulli. Now, Bernoulli lived several hundred years ago and was a sort of a polymath. But one of the things that Bernoulli wrote was as follows. If you're managing money for wealthy people, quote, the practical utility of any gain in value inversely relates to the size of the portfolio, unquote. Or in plainer English, if you're managing money, especially for wealthy people, but I think this touches on everybody who has assets of any size, of any significance. If you're managing money for wealthy people, just don't lose it. Because human beings, as sort of behavioral finance tends to suggest now, we're very loss averse, we're very risk averse. So, in other words, our attitudes to profits and losses are not the same. the Kahneman and Tversky, in their sort of Nobel Prize winning research, suggested that our in other words, if I offer you a bet and say, you know, we'll toss a coin, heads you win 100 quid, tails you lose 100 quid. And if you take that bet, if it comes up heads, you'll be happy. But if it comes up tails and you lose 100 quid, you'll be between 2 and 3 times as unhappy as you were happy, if you follow the logic. So it's not symmetrical. Our brains respond to profits and losses in different ways. And so on the back, I mean, this was a revelation to me when I came across it about, you know, 16 or 17 years ago. And as a result, from that moment on, I was converted to what I'd call absolute return investing rather than relative investing. So in other words, I'm not interested in benchmarks. I'm interested in capital preservation and real returns, because you can't take relative returns to the bank, especially they're negative.
No, I think that's a good point. And now you're having benchmarks being turned on their heads, in a sense of people are looking at what's actually been done with their money, how much it actually cost for them to gain that level of return as well. So lots of critique going on for the fund industry at the moment.
Oh yeah, I mean, again, it's a very difficult environment. So, you know, with interest rates basically at around zero, then any fund management fee clearly detracts from whatever the returns might be. But equally, I mean, fund management is a profession. So, or at least I hope it is.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that the people who genuinely can deliver the goods, you know, have a right to earn an income from that. But I think that the problem, I'd say, is the way I describe it is that imagine a bell curve on the far left. So you've got, you know, you've got a big bulge in the middle, and then you've got a tail on the left hand side and right hand side of the curve. The left-hand side of the curve, the thin tail there, represents, let's call them low-cost providers, i.e. exchange-traded funds and sort of low-cost vehicles. On the far right, on the right tail, you've got, let's say, the very best active managers, and they're high cost. So they're charging things like hedge fund fees. And then you've got a gigantic bulge in the middle that's basically useless.
Yeah.
That's pretty much, you know, index tracking, whether it acknowledges it or not. And that's, you know, that's just a waste of space. And I think I think investors are slowly waking up to this. But investing is also a very heavily intermediated business. So it's not like Joe Smith goes out and identifies the funds. In many cases, he'll buy what his advisor recommends to him.
Indeed. I mean, touching on bond market, there's a great quote from Bill Gross, which I'm sure you've heard before, when he said, "When does money run out of time? The countdown begins when investable assets pose too much risk for too little return, when lenders desert credit markets for other alternatives such as cash or real assets."
I think that's right. And there's another point I'd make, which is, well, actually, it's to question exactly what we mean by the word risk. Mm. Because risk is a term that's banded around all over the place. And again, we operate in a very heavily regulated environment.
Yeah.
But for me, I would define, I mean, in other words, it's important to identify what your terms are. You know, language means, you know, words have meaning. So it's important to know what we mean by things. And I would define risk as the risk of a permanent loss of capital. In other words, you had your pension, you had all your pension and your life savings in Lehman stock. Well, now you've lost everything. Now that's a risk. But day-to-day volatility, day-to-day price oscillations, if you like, that's not risk. That's just volatility. So they're not the same thing.
But to qualify that as well, all fund managers, whether it be the bond market or other, are paid regarding performance, aren't they? They should be paid regarding performance. The whole point is you're giving them the money to provide additional and better returns than you could do yourself.
No, for sure. So in a sense, you could argue that fund managers are paid or should be incentivized to deliver the best risk-adjusted returns.
Yeah.
But I think the issue is that investors also should appreciate that markets don't move in straight lines. Mm-hmm. So some of the time, you know, in other words, I don't know any investment strategy that never ever loses money. They all do at certain points.
Yeah, agreed.
So it's really a question of just being risk aware of what you own and why you own it.
So given that, then I'm going to touch on the second quote. I don't like to quote the same person too often, but because you're a bond specialist, I've just got a few quotes in front of me here. Bill Gross reiterates again. He says, "Bond investors want growth, much like equity investors, and to the extent that too much austerity leads to recession or stagnation, then credit spreads widen out. Even if a country can print its own currency and write its own checks," which is what the FOMC, US, and UK have started to do, and their debt's just going out of control.
I'm not sure I'd agree with him when he says that investors want growth. Bond investors want growth. I think what bond investors want is preservation of capital and income. And at the moment, they haven't got either. Because they've got huge price risk and duration risk, and now I suspect inflation risk. And they've got extremely poor credit quality, and they've got very derisory income. So this is why there is no chapter in the sort of solutions part of my book that recommends bonds. Because with one or two glorious exceptions, there's virtually no value in the bond market whatsoever. So, and this is important because the bond market is far bigger than the stock market. The value of issued debt dwarfs the value of the market capitalization of listed businesses. So it's a big deal when the bond market finally goes south.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on something regarding your book, Tim, and that's the impact of currencies and where it's gone at the moment, especially regarding the euro and more importantly sterling since Brexit.
Yeah. So I find currency. Trading, if you like, quite difficult because all you're doing is ultimately trying to find out which of a variety of bits of paper is worth more or less at any given time. Mm-hmm. And that's the sort of way I'd boil it down to be sort of slightly oversimplistic. And the problem is none of them are backed by anything. So it comes down to confidence as much as anything else. So if you were to ask me, for example, what the best currency is in the world, I'd say it's gold because it's the one currency that you can't print.
Right, okay. All right, so if we move on a little bit, I want to talk with regards to your own personal stance on investing and bonds, etc. Because obviously, as a fund manager, you've been doing it for a long time. You've got a certain skill set that's way beyond everybody else. So regarding your own personal criteria, Tim, how do you pick and choose what it is that you're putting in your personal portfolio and also in your funds that you hold and invest in personally regarding skin in the game for yourself?
Sure. So the way I describe the journey I've been on, I think it's one that many people go on, is you start out. I started out in the financial markets, and I think most people do who end up working in fund management in one capacity or another. And you start out as a trader. So what I mean by that is that you're expected pretty much to have a view on everything. Right. So in other words, someone says whether it's the Nikkei, whether it's the Dow, whether it's the topics, whether it's the bund to US Treasury interest rate spread, you're supposed to have a view on everything. Yeah. And as a result, you do have a view, but it's a very simple view. So it's like a mile wide, but like a centimeter deep. So it's a very shallow perspective. And then, at least this is how I think my career has developed, that the more you sort of, I think also investing really should be done in a way that's consistent with your character. Now, I'm very risk averse, but I'm also willing to be patient. Yeah. So what appeals to me is bluntly long-term value, for want of a better phrase, which is also probably the most successful strategy over the longer term. It beats just about everything.
I think it's certainly one good
mm-hmm. part of a tool set for people. Yeah. And again, this is the topic we cover at some length in the book. So I started out as a trader, and then as time went on and I started reading more and more about other successful investors, I started to think more like an investor and less like a trader. And what that effectively involved was shrinking the investable universe that I was willing to look at. So in other words, I stopped trying to have a view on everything and started having a view on a smaller subset of investments or assets that I could try and handle in greater detail. So that's the sort of the part of the journey. And then I think for me and for anybody, certainly who shares this mindset, the end point of that journey is to end up thinking like an owner. So you start as a trader, you migrate to being an investor, and each time you move up this ladder, the investable universe contracts meaningfully. And then the third stage is to think like an owner. And then you're not even really that bothered about day-to-day movements in stock markets because, given a choice, you'd prefer to own things outright the way people like Warren Buffett do.
Yeah. So as currently you're a value, you've always been a quality-led value investor and fund manager.
So I think so.
So looking at the present markets and given the uncertainty, which sectors are you looking at to say, right, okay, this is where the value is at the moment, given that, they could be flipped on the head, if Marie Le Pen comes in the next couple of months?
Sure. So the again, in terms of sort of other sources, the things that have been most meaningful in terms of what's influenced me, then I'd have to give due credit to Benjamin Graham's The Intelligent Investor.
Yeah.
And so what effect, what you get from, you know, a healthy dose of that is that you start to look at investments from the bottom up.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily have a sort of macro view on everything, mm-hmm. but you start to look at individual opportunities, again, from the bottom up, from the valuation up. And so the kind of stuff that Ben Graham, who was writing about this stuff 70, 80 years ago, the kind of stuff that he was looking for was high-quality businesses that, that were so cheap when you bought them that they offered what he called a margin of safety.
Yeah.
So you're looking for really a combination of things. You're looking for high-quality businesses, assuming you're looking at stocks, high-quality businesses with extremely disciplined shareholder-friendly management, and then you're looking to buy them only when you can pick them up at a discount. So in other words, you're trying to buy dollar bills for 40 cents.
Yes.
Now, courtesy of 7 or 8 years of QE, there aren't that many bargains out there, but I think there still are bargains, but they're along the road less traveled. So in terms of the markets that that we find most attractive within the fund, which is the VT price value portfolio that, that my colleague Killian and I run, 40% of that fund's in Japan at the moment. So kind of draw your own conclusions about which markets we like. But it's a lot of it is in Asia.
Right. Okay. So given that you've got the vast majority of the current fund in Asia, and Benjamin Graham's one of his famous quotes is "Wall Street people learn nothing and forget everything." Do you think it's likely that we're going to forget very quickly that Trump is going to be the elect or is the elect, and that the situation over there with regarding valuation in comparison to other markets and the current levels of debt is going to be forgotten anytime soon?
I don't think Donald Trump is an easily forgettable person. So, I mean, this is the point that everyone's trying to sort of parse what a Trump presidency means. And the immediate reaction so far has been bad for bonds, good for stocks, good for the dollar. He hasn't even entered office yet. So I think there's a danger of being somewhat premature. I am a broad believer in this so-called reflation trade. So I think, I mean, that, that would be consistent with the way government bond yields have behaved over the course of the last couple of weeks. But in the bigger picture, it doesn't really matter an awful lot to us because we've got very, very little exposure to the US. And again, in terms of our foreign investments, overseas investments, in other words, from the UK, they're all predicated on basically rather attractive, I'd almost call it deep value. Mm-hmm. So we've already got what we think and believe is a sort of margin of safety within what we own. Now, clearly, if Wall Street were to take a dive, then the rest of the world will be impacted. But
of course,
we're already trying to buy cheap stuff. So I think the bigger danger today is for those investors that are pursuing what you might call expensive defensives. In other words, the sort of global mega cap consumer-friendly stocks, the likes of the Unilevers and AstraZenecas of this world, which are trading on very rich multiples and, frankly, don't leave an awful lot of room for disappointment in terms of future revenues.
Okie dokie. So with regards to looking for deep value then, if you were looking in the UK, are you looking further out of the FTSE 250 and further down the market cap sort of arena?
We don't have any UK exposure in the fund at the moment, but that's not an express judgment call on the UK. It's simply because we're effectively the UK's being crowded out by much more attractive markets overseas, and we run a fairly focused portfolio. So we're at the exact opposite of an index fund or a benchmark fund. But if we were looking, we'd certainly be looking at small to mid caps. I think there is a terrific opportunity for all investors looking at small to mid-cap stocks right now. And the reason is because Wall Street isn't interested. They're not the large bulge bracket type firms just haven't got the time or the money or the inclination to research these kind of businesses because they don't make them any money. So what that does mean, you've got huge swathes of the stock market that are almost completely overlooked by the establishment. And that's a great opportunity.
Indeed. And there's quite a few fund managers that actually do delve into that as well.
Sure.
So with regards to your overseas exposure being mainly in Japan and other parts of Asia, is there a particular sector at the moment that you found the best value in?
No, we're fairly agnostic when it comes to sectors. So again, it's really down to individual opportunities at a bottom up level. Mm-hmm. We clearly want to be diversified. So in other words, we're not massive in tech, for example, but then we're not massive in banks either. So it's fairly, I'd say, agnostic when it comes to sectors.
Okay, so for private individual who doesn't have all the software and all the connections to get meetings with and
you know, eye-to-eye sort of contact with these fund managers and travel the world to get this sort of information. If they were to say, right, this is Tim's criteria, what would it be when you're whittling down and filtering to say, we're going to purchase this stock in this country for these particular reasons? Could you give some sort of clues as to
sure,
what
I mean,
to use, please?
So bear in mind that what we're looking to buy within the fund isn't necessarily stocks in isolation. We also buy funds. So what I'd say is, if you're looking to you know, to basically put your money with a third party fund manager, this is something that I dwell on at some length in the book.
Yeah.
The kind of qualities you're looking for are as follows. You first and foremost, you want to go with someone who's an asset manager, not an asset gatherer.
Right.
And I won't labour the point, but most asset managers are in fact asset gatherers. In other words, they're just part of gigantic fund machines that just hoover up money in the course of maximizing income for the people who work there. Now, that's fair enough, but I think you'll get a better return overall if you manage to locate someone who actually thinks more like an asset manager whose interests are completely aligned with those of his investors.
Yeah, smaller boutiques that have got...
So that would tend logically then to support people who, for example, will close their fund to new investors rather than just keep growing it to the sky.
Okay.
And that's something that we're well aware of, because value as a strategy is one that suffers from capacity constraints. So a number of the funds that we invest in within our own fund are already closed. So we're well aware of that. So firstly, asset management is a lot more interesting for us than simply asset gathering businesses. Secondly, you want ideally to find someone who's putting his money where his mouth is. So someone who eats his own cooking, someone who has put a meaningful amount of his own private wealth into his own fund. And this is, again, to go back to the point about bonds, this is one reason why I'm so wary about the nature of the structure of the international bond market, because I don't believe that the typical bond fund manager has a penny in his own fund. So why on earth should he care whether he makes or loses money, as long as he matches his index return?
Indeed. Okay.
So other than that, they're kind of variations on the same theme. From our perspective, we're clearly interested primarily or exclusively in value managers.
Yeah.
So we're less interested in, or not at all interested in, just growth for growth's sake. So the kind of what this brings you down is basically a rather small universe, a small opportunity set of people broadly behaving in the same way, but hopefully with a sort of definable process, a definable, articulatable process, and a process that's worked because you have the track record to prove it.
No, that's excellent. That's excellent. So Tim, I'm gonna ask this question, and I know that I've asked this before of others. If there was one thing, given what you know now and 25 years, in the capital markets, that you could change, that you didn't know when you left Oxford at 1991, what would it be?
I would move heaven and earth to try and abolish central banks.
Okay. And regarding the economists and their and analysis of what's coming and going and this changing foot all the time, is that the reasons?
Well, the reason for my hostility to central banks is because I fear that we are in a very dangerous financial environment, and it's an environment that's been made much more dangerous precisely by the very people who are supposed to be protecting it, namely the central bank. So the policy of quantitative easing hasn't been proven, and it's never worked. But we seem set to be getting more of the same.
Okay, so I will touch on it now while we're on this. We communicated about a week and a half ago after I saw a particular tweet from you regarding Mark Carney.
Yeah.
Now, what I was alarmed by was the fact that all of the stuff that was said pre-Brexit, or pre the vote, the EU ref, and what's been said since then has been completely turned on its head. And now you've got, to use the term, a league of gentlemen and led by one lady who are completely conflicted and still don't have a plan and don't appear to have a solution to what they've been left with.
Yeah, I mean, I was a passionate advocate for leave, so clearly I'm very happy with the way the vote went. I didn't expect it to win, but I'm very happy with the way it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And equally, as you say, we've had this sort of sea change in sentiment and in response to the referendum. I'm relatively sanguine about the fact that I think over time, our government is going to do the right thing. But I see all kinds of, I mean, I use social media a lot, and it's probably a guilty pleasure. But there's a lot of people saying, oh, government should do this, government should do that. But no, 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 we didn't vote for, you know, a specific set of outcomes. The vote we were all given back on the 22nd of June, 23rd of June, was completely binary. It was either we stay or we go. Well, by a margin of a million or so, we voted we're going to go. That's it. That's all they have to deliver. Now, clearly there's been economic disruption, particularly in the context of the currency market. But that's not been all bad news. It's clearly supportive for UK exporters. excuse me. But this thing, you know, we're talking about a very meaningful change in our trading relationship with the rest of the world.
Yeah.
It clearly involves a bit of short-term pain. But in the long run, I'm convinced we're going to be better off for it, because what I don't get is from the Remainers is they don't seem to recognise that the European Union is palpably failing at every level. You have a massive youth unemployment crisis across most of the periphery. You have a massive migration crisis, which nobody seems capable of resolving. And that is driven in part by this absurd commitment to free movement of people. Now, I'd like to think I'm not racist, but the UK population has basically said, enough, we're a crowded island, relatively crowded island, we want to take control of our own borders. And I don't see what's unreasonable about that.
I'm not sure there's anything unreasonable about it, but I think the question is that we're in this financial mess where we started the conversation because of finances and issues that, you know, go back as far as the US dropping the gold standard. And many years on, we're still in a financial mess because of banking and economists. And to quote Nassim Nicholas Taleb, years ago, I noticed one thing about economics, and that is that economists didn't get anything right. And it still carries on.
I know, it's bizarre, isn't it? So this is one reason why I'm so have such antipathy towards the central banks, because it's like the Wizard of Oz. There's nothing behind the curtain except people just sort of pulling levers and flipping buttons, but nothing's working.
Nothing's working.
And I think I mentioned this in the book, but there's an ominous sort of line from John Maynard Keynes, probably the most famous British economist, and he says, and this was written in the great slump of the 1930s, and he said, "I fear we've erred in the control of some delicate machine, and our prospects for wealth may sort of be poor for quite some time." Well, he was right about the prospects for wealth, because clearly the Great Depression lasted for years.
Yeah.
But where I think he was dead wrong was by comparing the economy to a machine. The economy is not a machine. The economy is the interaction of ultimately 7 billion people. So you can't model it. And the idea that you can is just fanciful. And that really gets to the heart of the problem that I have with central banks and with economists, because it's a false science. A proper science has testable theses. Economics has none.
Okay. I'm trying to think of... there's a famous quote I can't think of right now. It's Rod Blagojevich did a quote years back regarding that. But it's essentially, it ran round about the fact that a successful economic development strategy must focus on improving the skills of the workforce. Now, the UK, we don't produce enough stuff. We're a service-led economy. So until we start making things that are made within Britain by British companies, we're always going to be reliant on giving, in one hand, a pound to get back 50 pence from an overseas investor. You know, and that doesn't really, you know, generate enough revenue for us, does it, long term?
Yeah, I think, I don't claim to have the sort of policy prescriptions. That's not really my job or my mandate. But I imagine that the one thing that, again, has been messed around with by governments since time immemorial is the education system.
Of course, yeah.
I would suggest that if you want to try and ensure the healthiest possible economy, then you throw sufficient resources at education so that you have a well-educated and productive workforce.
Agreed.
Absent that, whatever government policies is going to be, it's a drop in the ocean.
Yeah, sticking plaster on a gaping wound, indeed.
Yeah.
Right, okay. What has been your greatest lesson you've attained since you started investing, Tim, please?
That's a very good question. Let me have a think for a second. Surround yourself with the best quality people you can possibly find.
Yeah, that's what we do at Share Talk. I'm glad you've touched on that one. Thank you very much. Okay. On a similar note, what has been your wisest investment decision to date, Tim?
At the level of an individual stock, there was a company called Washington Mutual. that I remember reading about in Barron's magazine in 1999 or maybe early 2000. And I was at Merrill Lynch at the time. And Barron's featured this stock. And Washington Mutual was a U.S. savings and loan, so the equivalent of our building society, effectively.
Okay.
And this stock had been completely smashed during the dot-com boom. So its stock price, you know, the price chart of this was your classic, you know, top left of the screen to bottom right of the screen sort of share price movement. It looked dreadful.
Yeah, a knife cutting through butter.
It was certainly catching a falling knife. It felt like it when we bought it. Mm-hmm. And yet, as Barron's pointed out, the company had just enjoyed multiple quarters of successively higher dividends and revenues.
Okay.
And the most recent quarter had been a company record.
Okay.
And it was trading on a price-to-earnings ratio of something like 4 or 5. And we thought, you know, this is interesting. So basically, after the fact, it was simply one of the many sort of old world businesses that got completely overlooked when everyone was flooding into TMT
in
99.
Yeah.
So we basically bought it, and it subsequently rallied by something like 300%. So that was one of the ones that worked.
Yeah. So with regards to ones that didn't work, and because I think we learned far more from our losers and failures, as they say.
Sure. So I'll give you the most notorious one that didn't work. So I won't identify the fund, but we had a fund that invested in junior gold miners, and you know, and we have typically, you know, within our wealth management business, we have roughly 20% allocated to bullion related investments, whether it's gold and silver or whether it's miners, and that strategy worked very well up until 2011, and then when the gold price fell from $1,900 to around $1,100, clearly didn't work quite so well. And although the gold price collapsed, the price of this fund collapsed even more.
Mm-hmm.
And so with the benefit of hindsight, you know, not only had we selected a fund that was clearly going to be more volatile than we'd anticipated, but also the structure was wrong, because it was a fairly small closed-ended investment trust. So not only did the assets collapse, but the structure itself was, with the benefit of hindsight, inappropriate. So, you know, kind of once bitten, twice shy. So as and when we start, you know, upping the risk, we'll try and give some more thought to not just the underlying asset case, but also the structure of what we own.
Okay. So Tim, looking back now, leaving Oxford in 91, and you looking into the mirror and looking at Tim, yourself in 1991, what would you say to yourself back in 91 as saying, right, okay, these are the things to... I wish I'd known then that what I know now.
Read more Ben Graham.
Yeah.
What else? Again, the observation from earlier, try and surround yourself with just the best quality people.
Okie dokie. I've more or less covered all my questions, and I usually ask about books, but you've touched on a few books there earlier. Is there any other book that you would consider sharing with our listeners, Tim?
Sure, there are two fantastic books about trading, more trading than investing, but they touch on the psychology of this business, and they're basically Market Wizards and The New Market Wizards by Jack Schwager, and they're interviews basically with some of the most successful investors, traders, and hedge fund managers out there. They are must-own books. It's the Market Wizards and the New Market Wizards. They're absolutely outstanding.
Thank you ever so much for that. Now, Tim, ShareTalk are going to be doing some events up and down the country. We've got one on Saturday, in fact, in Birmingham, which I'd invite you to. I know it's a bit short notice, but also we're going to do some more next year. So I just wanted to touch on the fact that we'd love to invite you as one of the potential speakers of one of our future shows, if that's possible.
I'd be delighted to get involved.
Okay, so are you currently based in London, or are you based back near towards Solihull or not?
No, I'm based in London.
Okie doke. So we'll talk a bit further at a later date. But Tim, thank you ever so much for sharing your insights.
My pleasure.
I wish you the absolute best with the
current
book of Investing Through the Looking Glass.
Thank you.
Irrational Guide to Irrational Markets by Herriman. And I'll speak to you soon, Tim.
Lovely. Thanks very much.
All right. Take care and God bless.
You too.